reason. Whether they think they're revenging wrongs done to themselves, their families, their people. Whether they think they're protecting their homeland, standing up for their rights. I'd wager there are very few of them who look in the mirror and see the bad guy. John Mungrel, though. Him, I'm not sure about. This was 2006, and he'd already been in Polesmoor for 19 years. The first 9 were for a murder he committed aged 14. The next 10 for the murder of an inmate inside. Rumour has it he's out now, and possibly even a reformed character, for which I'm supremely thankful, because the John Mungrel I met was about as far from a reformed character as it's possible to get. There was something about him. Something strange and terrifying and, yes, maybe even evil. The look of him, for a start, as though he'd been carved out of wood. His eyes, like those of a shark. And the calm, measured way he spoke, with none of the braggadocio of a gangster, nor any regret. Just a sort of nothing, as he told me what he did. We got to talk to him, because we were looking for somebody to represent the 28s. Somebody who would speak about them on camera. Most guys in the prison were terrified of speaking out, and with good reason, the penalty for doing so being death. But John Mungrel had, in his 2 decades inside, risen up the ranks of the numbers. One look at him, and it was easy to see why. As a general, I guess he had special privileges. He was allowed to speak. My 2 guards left the room, leaving me alone with him. When he leant forward, I caught a whiff of his breath. A rancid mix of roadkill, nicotine, and sour body fluids. He hadn't seen a dentist in a long time, if ever, and you could cut his breath with a knife. I asked him how he'd become involved with the numbers, and calmly, with the piercing stare that was his trademark, he told me that he had strangled and stabbed a man. He went on to say that he gave the orders in Polesmoor. If there was a warden who was not right, then John Mungrel decided whether he lived or died. Gang members who refused to follow his orders were killed. New inmates would be brought to his cell. And if he is not the number, I have sex with him. I did my best to maintain my soft face. How'd you have sex with him? You hold him down. I hold him down. My face to face. Did having sex with men mean he was gay? I asked him. His look left me in no doubt what he thought of that particular suggestion. No, he told me. He was not gay. He was a man. The wifey was gay. Mungrel told me how he sharpened a toothbrush into a lethal weapon by heating it up, then honing it to a fine point on the stone floor. He described killing a man, having other 28s hold the victim down while he first shoved the point of the sharpened toothbrush in between his ribs, then used his feet to stamp it into the heart as hard as he could. He described what happened after he killed his first warden. He was put in solitary confinement where the wardens came for him in the night. They beat him so badly he was knocked unconscious. Despite what you might see in films, this is no mean feat. In real life, you have to beat somebody very, very badly in order for them to lose consciousness. Mungrel made me touch his skull, which felt soft and springy beneath my fingers, a memento of the beating. After leaving him almost for dead, the guards put him on a diet of millet and water for 6 weeks. The thing about millet is that the human body cannot digest it at first. You have to chew it, pass it out in your shit, wash it with water, if you have any water, then eat it all over again. Only by eating it the second time around does the millet give you enough nourishment to keep you alive. It's a circle of brutality with no end and no beginning. As an outsider, all you can do is pray you never find your way onto the treadmill. The whole time we were talking, and we spoke for several hours, he was so scarily matter-of-fact about the atrocities he had done and continued to do, the abuse that had been heaped upon him, that I began to wonder whether the man opposite me was simply an out-and-out psychopath. Perhaps he had been completely dehumanized by what he had done and what had been done to him. However, talking to him was a great learning experience. I quickly realized that an interview is as much about getting the subject to relax, to open up, as it is about asking questions. And you do that by chatting to them in a non-judgmental way. Nowadays, when I do an interview, I have a rough idea of what I want to ask, what I want from the interview, and what we're seeking to explain to the audience. But aside from that, I go with the flow. I talk to the subject, and I make sure I don't judge. John Mungrel also taught me the value of patience. When I interviewed him, I didn't jump straight in with the big questions. I learnt the value of sitting back, in this case for some 4 hours, and establishing a rapport. So yes, in a way he taught me something. As I said to camera coming out of the interview, John Mungrel, interesting guy. What else could you say? K is for kit and caboodle. We carry up to 25 bags of kit on any given film. Lenses, mini cranes, tripods, camera bodies, and boxes of camera equipment. So as far as personal luggage goes, we try and keep it to a minimum. Here's a few of the essentials that get packed in my rucksack every time. Boots. And flip-flops. All right. See, B is for be careful where you... And a plentiful supply of socks, too. Flip-flops for my downtime to get air to my poor old plates of meat. One thing you have to look after is your feet. Cigarette lighters. Because it's handy to have, but also because if you're interviewing someone and they stick a cigar, a cigarette, or a spliff in their mouth, you can offer them a light. It's amazing how much goodwill you can get that way. Energy bars. Lots of days this is all we eat. It's one of the reasons we were so glad just for the chicken and chips in San Francisco, the one in Peru. A hat. Or a headscarf. Or a bandana of some kind. Something to protect your head in hot climates. Bald heads in particular. Hostile environment training. You have that before you go out. It's common sense to get it. Although you have to have it for insurance purposes, and you have to update it regularly too. A good knife. Obviously, be careful where you carry it and where you take it. You don't want to be walking around the streets of a city carrying a knife, but if you're in the jungle, have 2 knives in case you lose one. Medical kit. And it's a good idea to make sure you know how to use the contents as well. Mosquito repellent, nets. When it comes to mosquito spray, DEET is the stuff. It'll melt your watch strap, but it works. Suntan lotion, particularly for my head. The higher the factor, the better. I'm not there on holiday. Sweets, to raise morale and occasionally make friends. Torch, head torch. Both are essential. And plenty of batteries, of course. Water. And chlorine tablets to purify the water or a flask with a charcoal filter. The chlorine tablets make the water taste disgusting, like drinking a swimming pool, basically, but at least you reduce your chances of getting D and V. See, S is for I love the smell of shit pits in the morning. Wet wipes. Preferably antiseptic for the occasional shit in the woods. L is for lost in translation. Visiting the Democratic Republic of the Congo for Extreme World wasn't exactly a laugh-a-minute experience. And what laughs we did have were after the event rather than during it, our hellish stay in Walikale being a prime example. See, A is for Avez-vous la berth. Another example was meeting the Mai Mai, a militia set up to defend themselves against other militia. These are the guys who, when I spoke to them, told me they drank a herbal potion that made them bulletproof. And while I'm not one to judge, and certainly not when it comes to cultures I know so little about, I think I can safely say they were misguided on that score. Tempting, then, to think of them as a bit backward. A bit simple. Not a bit of it. It doesn't matter where you go in the world, people love a piss take. And as it turned out, the Maimai were no different. Arriving at a parade ground near to the community, we were treated to what we thought was a charming traditional African welcome of singing and chanting. Having got our footage, we thought the translation was this. The white man is filming us, but we are watching him. We are watching him. The white man is filming us, but we are watching him. We are filming him. However, when we had the film double-checked prior to transmission, and bloody lucky that we did, what emerged was a slightly different version. A remix, if you like. The cheeky boys and girls had changed the lyric halfway through. Anybody watching who understood the dialect they were using would have heard this. The white man fucked us all night, never paid us a thing. Oops. Some judicious editing of the piece was required in order to remove the offending lyrics, and we breathed a huge sigh of relief, while secretly congratulating the Maimai on a cracking practical joke. M is for minefield, or mind out the way, Mark McCauley. Despite the rather flippant title, I still, after all these years, feel like a right knob for what I did to our cameraman, Mark. In my defence, I was operating on a kind of fight-or-flight mechanism, specifically the flight bit of it. It all happened during the making of the second series of Afghanistan, when I was with 45 Commando, Victor Company, Fire Support Group in Kajaki, and moving up on a hill adjacent to a Taliban stronghold known as the Big Top. The FSG's job is to provide covering fire for troops on the ground, and doing that means making good use of elevated positions. But of course the Taliban know that, so the hills are seeded with IEDs. One Marine had already tragically lost his life to one. Once an area is designated free of IEDs, it's marked with white powder, and as we moved up the hill we were warned that the only safe path was between the white lines. Whatever we did, we had to stay between the lines. Going was slow as we trudged up the hill. At the bottom was the Jackal, an armoured vehicle. In front of me was Sven and Scotty of the FSG. Behind me was Mark, filming. And then it happened. We were stopped by the command, "Back off!" The Marines discovered a large IED with a command wire attached. We began to retreat to the foot of the hill. At the same time, the enemy opened fire. I heard the zip of automatic gunfire, the unmistakable feel of rounds parting the air close to the top of my head, and knowing we were hideously exposed, I turned and ran. I barreled straight into Mark, knocked him over before going sprawling myself. From behind, I heard shouts, the bang of gunfire, and the whistle of rounds passing overhead, and I picked myself up and kept on running. The kind of running I was doing, they call it the swastika, because of the shape of your arms and legs. And I swastikaed right down that hill just as fast as I could. Two things I should have done. Number one, I should have stayed between the white lines. "Ross, stay on the track!" roared Sven from behind me, but it wasn't until I saw the footage later that I even heard him. At the time, I was concentrating on reaching the Jackal, and no way was I remembering to stay between the white lines. I zigzagged my way down the slope until I made it to the safety of the Jackal, and nothing but dumb luck stopped me stepping right onto an IED. Number two, I should have stopped to pick Mark up, especially as it was me who'd knocked him over in the first place. As it was, Sven hauled him up and picked up the camera so filming could continue, and Mark made it to the Jackal safely. But yeah, I didn't stop to help my mucker up. What can I say other than self-preservation got the better of me and, well, sorry, Mark. N is for never walk around the back of a helicopter. Many moons ago, in 1999, when a younger, more innocent Ross was preparing to leave the cloistered environs of EastEnders at Elstree and set sail for ITV, I took part in a documentary called Ross Kemp Alive in Alaska. As far as the TV side of things was concerned, I suppose you'd have to say that Alive in Alaska was a precursor to I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, where they'd stick a well-known face in the back of Beyond and watch them try to survive. Lenny Henry did one. Joanna Lumley did another, and Billy Connolly did A Scot in the Arctic. And from a me point of view, well, like I say, it marked the point at which I began to establish a separate identity away from Grant and EastEnders, and it gave me a taste for documentary making and adventure. It also taught me something useful about helicopters. My Alive in Alaska experience began in a helicopter, the plan being to land in the Klondike somewhere. I wasn't on my own, not at that stage of the game anyway. There was a cameraman and a sound man who'd been taken up on a previous run, the idea being that they would film me as I was dropped off. Nor was I going in completely green. I'd had some cold weather training to prepare me. Still, my heart sank as I stared out of the helicopter windows, seeing snow and ice and spindly trees as far as the eye could see, and knowing that whatever training I'd had, it could never prepare me for the reality. It would be true of Afghanistan, true for Extreme World, for which we have to have regular hostile environment training, and it was true of Alaska. Bear in mind, I was used to pulling pints at the Vic. Suddenly, I was being schooled in how to survive the freezing climate, or at least how best to try and survive the freezing climate, and thanks to the fact that they'd given me a .375 Winchester, a bear gun, I was given some weapons training as well. But nothing about how to deal with helicopters. And if there had been helicopter training, lesson one would have been, never walk around the back of one when its rotors are turning. Why? Because you don't see the tail rotor turning, it's going so fast. The tail boom just seems to end. You ever wondered why tail rotors are often painted in garish, alternating colours? It's to make them as visible as possible and reduce the hazard for ground crews. But you can paint the rotor all the colours of the rainbow. Paint it in reflective pink neon if you want, and you still won't see it in a whiteout, a blizzard, which was the weather that day. And if you're landing in a blizzard, where you can't hear or see anything, and where your senses are completely obliterated by the stinging weather, then it's even more important you don't wander around the back of the helicopter. So what does Muggins here do? Jumping out of the helicopter, trying to remember that we're filming while also endeavouring to get my backpack, I scrambled out of the helicopter and darted right around the back of it. I didn't see it, obviously. Thanks to the blizzard, I didn't hear it either. But I felt it. A whooshing sound by my ear that stopped me dead in my tracks, and I knew that I'd come that close to becoming human coleslaw. So, bloody dangerous things, tail rotors. If only helicopters could do without them, right? Fast forward to 2010, when I made the Battle for the Amazon films. And we were flying over the Ecuadorian rainforest, so I could do a piece to camera introducing the film and giving the viewer an extraordinary panoramic view of the jungle beneath. Aussie cameraman Steve Lidgerwood, a renowned cameraman and a great guy, was working with me, as well as the sound man Tim Watts. The director, Southern Morris, was in the helicopter too, along with the translator and, very important this, the pilot. Getting the shot we wanted involved me hanging out at the helicopter, not James Bond style, but getting strapped into a harness, then leaning out of the open door with my feet on the landing skid. That way the shot was composed of me and the rainforest, rather than a titchy bit of me, a titchy bit of the rainforest, and a huge chunk of helicopter interior. Because of the size of the helicopter, we had to take out the rear window in order to get the shot we needed. It's not unknown. They're designed to come out, after all. But I can tell you this, it doesn't exactly make for a comfortable ride. Still, sod that. The shot was going to look great. I mean, we were convinced the shot was going to look great, and as a result, lavished a lot of time on getting it to look good, screaming at each other as we were buffeted by winds and persuading the pilot to hover whenever we could. Was the hovering to blame for what later happened? I don't know. But I subsequently discovered that despite being built to hover, indeed being famous for their hovering abilities, helicopters don't actually like to do it. It kind of knackers them out. Especially older helicopters, like this one was. I'd say we filmed from around 6 a.m. until 11 a.m. The idea was that we'd then fly on to Yasumi to rendezvous with the producer, Tom Watson, who'd gone on ahead because there was too much kit to fit in one helicopter. So when the filming eventually finished, that's where we headed. Perhaps we'd asked too much of the chopper, what with all the hovering and swooping we'd been doing, but as we skimmed across the top of the forest, the nose of the aircraft was just, I don't know how you'd describe it, but I suppose you'd have to say it was flicking a bit. Just every now and then, a little bump that made you start a little, but nothing to be concerned about. Or so I thought. Like I say, there were six of us in this bird, but thanks to the current configuration of headphones, only Southern and I could speak to each other without bawling our throats out. He was the director, and he'd been directing me for the piece to camera, so it made sense we could speak. Anyway, the nose was doing this flicking thing, and suddenly Southern, who by that point was sitting next to the pilot, said, "Oi, Ross." "Yes, mate," I said. He was turned in his seat, and I got that weird sense of dislocation you get when you can see someone's lips move, but the sound comes through your headphones. "Can you just check the tail rotor is working, mate?" he said. "Oh, shut up, Southern." He's a bit of a wind-up merchant. Was then, and probably still is now. And to be honest, I was just not in the mood. We'd been buffeted by the wind all morning. We were all hungry. We were travelling deeper into the Ecuadorian rainforest. It wasn't the time for fun and games. "No, really," he said. "The pilot says, can you check if the tail rotor is still working?" I pulled a face at him. "You are kidding me." As if to make the point, the nose of the chopper did its little flick thing. No, mate," said Southern, very seriously, and I could tell by his face he wasn't kidding. The way his face was sort of grey. "No, mate, I ain't kidding." I swallowed something hard, and then, still strapped into my waist harness and with one foot braced on the landing skid, leant out and craned my head to look at the tail rotor. What I wanted to see was a nice, spinning, coleslaw-making tail rotor, just like in Alaska. What I actually saw was a wheezing, sputtering tail rotor. A tail rotor that looked like it was on its last legs. And the thing is, you need a tail rotor. It's not like it's decorative, or a spare little rotor that's handy to have in case the big one gives out. No, what it does is counteract the torque of the main rotor. Which is why, when it started to wheeze and splutter like ours was doing, the nose of the chopper was doing its flicking thing. And as though to celebrate being noticed at last, the helicopter began to behave even more erratically. "Yeah?" prompted Southern, who hardly needed an answer given what the helicopter was now doing. "It looks fucked," I told him, using the technical jargon. Southern went a lighter shade of grey. "All right," he said, and conferred with the pilot. "Pilot says we got to head back to Coca Airport," he confirmed. Coca Airport was our base. Looking round the cabin, I saw faces that mirrored my own fear. The thing about a broken tail rotor is that the pilot can usually force a crash landing. It's bad, but it doesn't have to be fatal. If you can land in the right place, that is. And the rainforest is just about the opposite location to the right place. Even if you avoided being impaled by trees on the way down. Even if the helicopter didn't ignite. Even if you weren't mutilated by alligators, poisoned by snakes, or bitten by spiders, then how the hell were you going to get out of there when nobody knew where you were? But as long as the tail rotor kept spinning, we'd be okay. I watched as the pilot, with sweat streaming freely down the side of his face, began desperately twiddling knobs, flicking switches and pressing buttons, doing whatever it was he needed to do to keep the bloody thing in the air. Every now and then I twisted in my seat to look out at the rotor, daring to hope it would suddenly spark back into life properly. My heart sinking when instead of getting better, it just seemed to be getting worse. Next, the pilot was calling Mayday, and I really started to panic. Below us, I saw a gas terminal and wondered if the short apron could be used as a makeshift landing pad. "No," said the driver, speaking through Southern. "Can't land there because they won't let you land there if you're a Mayday because of the risk of explosion. Oh, perfect. 15 minutes to go. There was plenty of leakage in the cabin as we sweated every second, knowing the tail rotor could conk out any moment now, and the chopper began to descend in what would hopefully be a controlled spin, crashing through the canopy of the wild and untamed rainforest, depositing us into a slow, drawn-out death. 10 minutes to go, and by now it felt as if the rotor was more off than it was on. I'd look out, see it spinning, and wonder if it was actually motorized or just rotating in the wind, having all the effect of a child's windmill. The pilot contacted Coker to let them know we were about to attempt an emergency landing with a damaged tail rotor, and I imagined the ground crews scrambling into action. 5 minutes to go, and through Southern, the pilot warned us that he'd be shutting off the engine to land. He didn't actually use the phrase controlled crash, but for some reason that's what came to mind. And then we were coming into land. We were going to land like a plane, and for a moment it was as though we were gliding and very much in the lap of the gods. And fair play to the pilot, he got us down. It wasn't going to win any awards for comfort, and it was very bumpy, but he got us down, sliding in on its rails, and we scrambled out of the cabin on weak and rubbery legs to be greeted by the sight of emergency vehicles tearing across the apron towards us. Old-style, 1950s-looking emergency vehicles they were. Fire engines with clanging bells and guys hanging off the sides who greeted us as though we'd just returned from a moon landing. It felt like we had. Still, we now had another problem. Tom was stuck with a tribe that was still killing strangers up until around when I was born. We had no way of telling him to get his arse back. He had no idea we weren't coming. We were stuck in Coca without a brass farthing. And that, as they say, is another story. To be continued in T is for a totemic tropical takeoff. O is for, oh, is this a stick-up? Thanks to Afghanistan, I've been shot at a few times, and thanks to gangs, I've spoken to countless guys holding guns. But having someone actually point a gun at you with his finger on the trigger is something that I don't want to get used to. We went to Papua New Guinea, PNG, in 2013, hoping to learn more about this country where violence is so endemic, tribal conflict is a part of everyday life, and drugs and alcohol are such a destructive part of the culture, and where the second biggest business in the whole country is security. First port of call, a hospital in the capital, Port Moresby, where we found an interesting system in place. Because nearly half the admissions are trauma cases, eating up 40% of the hospital's budget, doctors have instigated a system of trauma fines, where anyone admitted as a result of fights or alcohol-related incidents must pay a fee in order to be seen. The root of the epidemic is a tribal system of payback. That same cycle of violence I've seen all over the world. Everywhere you go, people are working out their grudges using guns and knives. For the doctors at the Port Moresby Hospital, it was especially frustrating, because for each casualty admitted, they knew they'd have to expect at least one more, the payback for the first one, then another, and another, and so on. The further you travel out of Port Moresby, the more feral PNG gets. So understandably, we were fairly nervous about leaving the relative safety of the capital and setting off for the highlands. We knew that attacks from armed bandits called rascals are common. Their modus operandi is to stop cars, then rob and rape the occupants. Luckily, we'd made contact with a guy called Mike, a guy who'd once been one of the most wanted rascals in the whole of Papua New Guinea. He had dreads piled high on his head, an old shotgun wound to his face, and a long beard. And though he seemed nice enough, I had to keep reminding myself that he was probably responsible for some fairly reprehensible deeds. You don't become the most wanted man in PNG for nothing. Oh, and he was also the current major of Madang. Still, it's never too late to change. And by all accounts, that was what Mike had done. I thanked God he was the one in the driving seat, as we negotiated the increasingly chaotic Mendi Highway in order to link up with a convoy 5 hours' drive away. The bus station we reached, well, I said on the film it was like something out of Apocalypse Now, like the last signpost for civilization before you step off into the unknown. Around us were bright, shining halogen lights, strung from run-down shacks. Figures moving in the shadows. A sense of desperation in the air. Joining the convoy, Mike told me that if anybody ran in front of the car with a gun, the best thing to do was to simply hit him with the vehicle. That was reassuring. It was about an hour outside the bus station, and we were driving through thick mud in the pitch black when Mike told me, "Lock your doors." Funnily enough, they were already locked. But as our headlights illuminated an overturned oil tanker and ghostly figures loitering by the side of the road, some of them smoking, I saw why he'd given the instruction. Locals, some of them armed with machetes, were looting the oil tanker. They wouldn't rest until it was empty, Mike said as we edged past, several sets of curious eyes on us. Reaching Goroka in the eastern highlands of Papua New Guinea, I saw for myself the problems created by home-brewed alcohol. Guys sat around a rudimentary distillery getting absolutely smashed. I mean, I like a drink, but bloody hell, these blokes were totally hammered, and hammered like I'd never seen before. The distillery looked like it could explode at any second, but of course the booze hounds were so trashed they didn't care. You had guys carrying bush knives just completely zonked out. Until, that is, something upset them, which was when the violence started. As I watched, three of them started throwing punches, quickly joined by a fourth. It was like the kind of fight you see outside a pub on a Saturday night in Croydon, steaming drunk people throwing wild punches, except this got worse. And as we made our excuses and left, one of the drinkers came crashing out of the forest, his arm spouting blood from a machete wound. He then tackled a banana tree, felling it and himself in one fell swoop. The whole feeling I was getting was one of complete lawlessness. Who was in control, I wondered. The answer, apparently, was tribal enforcers, and our fixer, Lucas, reckoned he could set up a meeting with one of the region's most feared tribal enforcers, a rascal called the General. The General was part of Lucas's tribe, the Siku, and according to Lucas, was unpredictable and cunning. Feared by virtually everyone, it was said that during tribal warfare, he'd rubbed pig's blood on his gun prior to a kill. Even with that kind of billing, the General still turned out to be more out there than I could possibly have imagined. I suppose I should have been more suspicious when, on our way up the hill to meet the General, Lucas started hanging back and told us to go the rest of the way by ourselves. The three of us looked at each other. Me, Ed Venner, the director soundman, and Jonathan Young, the cameraman. But we kept going, joining a path that cut through some shacks before coming up short in a clearing as a number of men materialized from the jungle in front of us. There were four of them. At their head was a guy who wore a baseball cap and a camouflage jacket. What's more, and this was slightly odd, his face was blacked up, completely covered with black camouflage stick. Why? I don't know. After all, the guy was black in the first place. Maybe it was to stop the glare of the sun, or maybe it was an attempt to disguise his features. Maybe it was because he wanted to appear spooky and weird, in which case, well done, General. You looked spooky and weird. Who directed you, he asked us, looking from me to the crew. Lucas, I replied feebly. We were told that we were going to meet some guys who'd been involved in some trouble. That depends on what you want to know, I was told. They'd come trailing clouds of weed smoke. They were chewing betel nut, a mild stimulant. I was offered a drag on something I was told was tobacco. I had little choice in the matter, so I had a quick puff, handed it back, and was asked to try betel nut. They were testing me, it seemed. And then it happened. The General ducked, and from behind us appeared four men pointing guns at us, two with bolt-action rifles, the other two with shotguns. They were all blacked up like the general, wearing camouflage, and they ordered us to sit down. I stared at them. I'm not exactly sure exactly what I was thinking at that point, but I did have a strong instinct that I was not going to do as I was told. No way was I going to get down. What was going through my mind was that these guys had raped and killed outsiders in the recent past, men and women. That was what was going through my mind. So whatever happened, I wasn't going down. I'd rather die quickly with a bullet in me than the alternative. Around me, one of the general's men had already got down. Ed stood frozen, as petrified as I was. Jonathan, God love him, kept filming. Another thing that occurred to me. I'd heard one of the guys with the bolt action load the rifle. In films, gunmen do the ch-ch-ch thing because it looks and sounds good on screen. But in real life, if you're going into a situation like that, you chamber a round before you go into action. On the other hand, he could just have been putting one up the spout to freak me out. "Show us your round," I told him, grabbing hold of the barrel and pushing it away from me. By now, two of them had turned their attention to me, and one of the guys with the shotgun was being aggressive. He'd come round to the front, jabbing the barrel of the shotgun right in my face and yelling, "Get down!" That feeling of not wanting to do as I was told persisted. But it was joined by another feeling. The one of being royally pissed off that this guy was poking a gun in my face. "You gonna kill me?" I asked him. It wasn't the coolest thing to say, but hey. I grabbed the barrel of the shotgun. I had the bottle of water in one hand, the other holding the barrel, and I advanced on the gunman, making him retreat as I kept repeating, "Are you going to kill me?" "Sit down," he commanded. "No," I told him, repeating, "Are you going to kill me?" Our eyes locked, and he got the message. He realized that there was no way I was going down. It was time to either back off or pull the trigger. He stood down, and almost as quickly as it had kicked off, the situation seemed to diffuse. On the general's command, the four guys lowered their weapons. The guy with the shotgun even smiled. I was babbling, "No one's gonna fucking kill me," which again might not have been the coolest thing in the world to say, but I was riding a major hit of adrenaline and was in no fit state to be cool, so you'll have to forgive me. "You're very courageous," said the general, after I had assured him I wasn't going down, not for anyone. Looking back now, what I see is myself in a state of shock, at first pretending the whole thing wasn't really happening, quite casually taking a swig of water, then realizing that I had to do something or risk putting myself, Ed, and Jonathan at their mercy, which I was sure was the worst thing possible to do. Was it a setup just to intimidate us? I don't know. Maybe they wanted to rile us up. Maybe they wanted to show us how strong and powerful they were. Or maybe they planned to steal the camera and kill us. I'm not sure. If it was prearranged, then it was clear not all of the general's men were in on the joke, because at least one of them had hit the deck when the gunmen arrived. Whatever their motives, I still feel angry about what happened. But all I know is that afterwards we got a great interview from the general, who was clearly an intelligent man. But I guess if I've learnt anything from these films, it's to expect the unexpected, and to definitely come up with a better line than, "Oh, is this a stick-up?" P is for a prostitute called Margarita. Among the delights of Venezuela, a lovely chocolate and beautiful women. But like everywhere in the world, it's a country with a huge wealth gap. Take a seat in one of the more expensive hotels in its capital, Caracas, and you could be in Miami or Los Angeles. The atmosphere, the service, the food, it's all good. Go a short distance, though, and not even that short a distance, see Z is for Zebra Crossings in Venezuela, and you'll witness desperate poverty and crime firsthand. Where you get poverty, you get drugs and crime. And in the barrios of Caracas, drugs and crime are alive and kicking, believe you me. We were there for an episode of Extreme World, and, as is often the case, began by visiting a local hospital, in this case the Pérez de León. Within 5 minutes of turning up on a Friday evening, two bodies were being carted in. They were an off-duty policeman and his wife, who had been sitting in the car, both shot dead. Not a pretty sight. Next, a girl arrived who'd been shot in the leg. I stood and watched with a mixture of horror, admiration and bemusement as medical staff got to work, cleaning up the wound and delivering little lectures about the dangers of hanging around barrios with the wrong sorts. I'd hazard a guess that they were more than usually stingy with the pain relief for cases they considered less worthy. In fact, I think the message was, if you're going to hang around drinking in barrios, then you risk getting involved in a drive-by and shot. And now I'm going to stick my thumb in the wound just to make sure the bullet hole has been cleaned with iodine, and of course you're going to scream, and yes, maybe I could have used a little more pain relief and been a bit more gentle, but then again, that's what happens when you hang around the barrios getting drunk with the wrong crowd. Maybe this experience will make you think twice next time. Something like that, anyway. Later, during our time in Venezuela, we would speak to the brother of Carlos the Jackal, which was a pretty weird experience. Even so, it paled into insignificance compared to our visit to the main jail in Caracas. We were told we could go into this prison and meet the inmates, but cameras were not allowed inside. Now, this particular prison is under what they call inmate administration, the full meaning of which I was about to discover, but it was guarded on the outside by the Venezuelan military. So, for an initial fact-finding mission, we went in without a camera. First impressions. Waddling down the main corridor was a pig with the biggest pair of bollocks you've ever seen. Then there was a swimming pool. That's right, a swimming pool with children playing in it. There were guys fitting braces, having their hair cut, having piercings, tattoos. There were women walking around, men and women kissing. The sounds of what can only be described as exuberant lovemaking coming from within cells. And yes, in case you thought I'd wandered into a scene out of Logan's Run by mistake, there were actual cells in the prison along with the swimming pool, the conjugal visits and the odd, well-endowed pig. Oh, and Christmas lights. Really? There were Christmas lights strung up everywhere. Caracas is constantly getting blackouts, and now I knew why. All the electricity was being used to power the Christmas lights in this place. They had a huge snowman blowing snow out of his mouth into a ball the size of a car. It was the sort of thing you'd see in a big shopping centre back at home. That's where all the power was going. So, obviously, I was walking around thinking, I definitely wanted to film inside here. Making Extreme World has taken me into some pretty grim prisons. CJ is for John Mungrel, but this one was just totally surreal. Next thing, we met Leo, who was the big boss of the prison. I asked him if we could get a camera into the jail. He shrugged and said, no problem, you get a camera in here, no problem. Lovely guy. Immaculately dressed. Though we never found out what he was imprisoned for, the fact that he was constantly surrounded by a kind of Praetorian guard was proof of the enormous power he wielded within the prison. He showed us his cell, which was a perfectly nice cell. He had a big Bible on a lectern and pictures of his wife, who he'd met while inside. All in all, it was a pretty nice cell inside a nice, Christmas-decorated prison. Except, the place had a smell. And as I began seeing some of the less well-presented areas from which the smell emanated, I discovered it was the smell of crack. A few corridors away from the swimming pool and the Christmas lights and conjugal visits were tables, the kind you might see outside a pub on the A1. On them was more crack than I've ever seen, either before or since. Rocks and rocks and rocks of it. The weird thing was, the crack was arranged in pretty little patterns. Waves and swirls and Aztec shapes. Patterns created by the dealers as a way of making their particular product look unique. A way of selling it, I suppose. It was almost beautiful. It would have been beautiful, perhaps, if they really had been crystals, the kind of stones little kids like collecting, rather than one of the most addictive and destructive substances on the planet. So I was thinking, how on earth were we going to get the camera in? For a start, there was no way we were going to be able to use the usual camera we'd take on a job like this. What we decided to do was use an SLR camera, one that took a memory card on which we could fit about 10 minutes' worth of film. How to get it in? Leo told us to find a prostitute named Margarita, who not only worked the area outside the prison, but came in and out on a regular basis. She would bring the camera in and take it out for us. How was she going to do it? The answer was, don't ask. As you can imagine, we were mega dubious about the idea. Still, making the films, you end up putting yourself in situations where you simply have no choice but to trust somebody, and this was one of those times. Sure enough, when we left the prison that day, we began asking people on the outside if they knew her. Me, Southern Morris, the director, the cameraman Steve Lidgerwood, and the female fixer, trawling around the square in search of a prostitute called Margarita. At a beer vendor, we struck gold. Ah, Margarita, he said knowingly, and tipped us a wink before sending a kid off in search of the elusive Margarita. We sat and drank beers, still wondering if we were making a huge mistake. A few minutes later, the kid returned with a woman, I'd say, in her mid-40s, bigger than most, you'd have to say, but a real character. What's more, she already knew exactly what we wanted. We handed over about £3,000 worth of camera to her, with me thinking, I'm never seeing that again, and Steve looking at me with a look in his eyes like, what the hell are you doing? She smiled enigmatically, and that was it. She was gone. We left, minus one camera, feeling like I don't know what. Uncertain. Stupid. Like mugs who'd just been ripped off. We had no idea what we were supposed to do. Our only instructions were to come back 5 days later when all would become clear. So we did as we were told. We arranged a second fact-finding visit for 5 days' time, drove back to the prison, went to the beer vendor, asked for Margarita. The guy shook his head. No, no, no idea where Margarita is. And we were about to begin shouting at each other, each one laying the blame at the other's feet, when the beer vendor grinned. The camera! Is it the camera you're after? Yes, yes, it was the camera. Hope dawned as the beer vendor laughed and told us that Margarita had done as she was asked. She'd smuggled the camera into the prison. We looked at one another. Okay, right. That was a good start. We thanked the beer vendor and headed towards the prison gates. Sure enough, when we met with Leo inside, he had our camera. We'd smuggled mics in, and I had one taped to my chest as we joined him for what was to turn out to be a much more comprehensive and more eye-opening tour of the jail, not just the holiday camp side of it. Oh, no. We were about to get the full warts-and-all experience. We began by revisiting the good bits so we could film. Leo's private basketball court, the various satellite dishes up around the place, the library's brand new DVDs, music everywhere. Something else I noticed were strategically placed blocks of concrete. These, I realized, were armaments. Comfortable though the prison was, for the privileged inmates at least, we'll get to the less privileged prisoners in due course, it had been the scene of several riots, the most recent one lasting for 30 days. When the riot was eventually quelled by the army, troops found something like 70 kilograms of cocaine, rocket launchers, AK-47s, M-16s, and a lot of very dead people. The concrete blocks were defensive and were strategically placed in order to form firing positions. If things kicked off in the prison, Leo and his men could retreat to an armed and well-defended inner sanctum. Clever guy. He had a fortress at the tip of his fingers. A fortified zone. I managed to glean a little more information from Leo. Though he still didn't divulge why he was in prison, it became clear he was a member of a respected family, by which I took to mean crime family. I asked him, are you safer in here than you are outside? Leo looked around his well-appointed cell, with its shower, pictures of his wife and children, all of whom had been born while he was in prison, and all of whom appeared very well looked after, and he nodded, "Yes, yes, probably safer in here." He also had a set of rules for inside the prison. The rules were very simple. You abide by the rules. It was at this point that we started to hear about the other side of the prison. The other side of the prison was where you were sent if you broke the rules, Leo's rules. If you were caught stealing, for example, then you were sent to the other side of the prison. You could smoke crack on the nice side of the prison, but if you became addicted to it, and if you know anything about crack, then you'll know how easy that can be, then you were sent to the other side of the prison. So, I suggested, let's go look at this other side of the prison. It was reached via a barred door guarded by men holding shotguns. We passed through the gate into a corridor that at first I thought was empty, until I realized there were bodies slumped against the walls. Not dead bodies. Their eyes glowed in the dark as they stared up at me, muttering, whimpering. The only English words I could make out were, "Help me. Please help me." And the stench. Again, it was the chemical smell of crack, of ether and kerosene. The walls were thick with sticky crack residue, as though somebody had come along and tried to paint them in brown tar. And then, just below that, the smell of shit, rancid human shit. The prisoners in this part of the jail simply hurled the feces out of the windows where it baked in the sun. And trust me, that's a smell you don't want to get used to. With a hand over his mouth, Leo said, "Why should I look after these people? Look at them, they are lost." "Yeah," I thought, glancing at him, "but why was that?" "Can you make it back to the good side of the prison?" I asked as we trod deeper into the groaning, pleading shadows. "Very rarely," was the answer, "unless you get released. And getting released doesn't often happen." It took me a while to get my head around it, but the way it sounded was that if you were thrown in that part of the prison, that was it. Goodbye. Adios. You would more than likely never be seen or heard from again. On the other side of the prison, Leo and his guards kept their weapons concealed on their person. That, I think, was one of Leo's rules. But here, on the other side, in Hell's waiting room, the guns were taken out from their waistbands by his guards, so they were visible to the poor souls within, warning the consequences if they tried anything. Not that they looked capable of trying anything. These guys weren't so much living as subsisting, surviving. Everywhere I went were barely clothed men crouched in corners or lying in hammocks strung up between filthy walls like giant cocooned moths. There were guys sleeping on the floors, men in crack comas. Their skin was like parchment or scorched leather. In the dark, their eyes glowed and their mouths were black holes. They had no teeth. Deeper, we went into the dark, stinking bowels of the jail, and everywhere was the same murmuring and whimpering of skeletal men in rags, of crack addicts emaciated in every way, their bodies wrecked, their spirits sucked dry. I met a Dutch guy who'd been caught trying to take cocaine out of the country. Perhaps you've seen the movie Midnight Express. Here he was, living the film, only a far more terrible and horrifying version of it, for real. 21 when he was caught. He'd been in the prison for 8 years, and was hopelessly addicted to crack, the spark of life behind his eyes tragically dim. He would die in here, I knew. I was sure of it. I've rarely been more grateful to leave anywhere than I was that prison that day. As we finally stepped out into the sunshine and fresh air and went to the beer vendor in order to wait for Margarita, I wondered about Venezuela and the socialist dream of its leader, Chavez. Whatever you thought of the prison's workings on the outside, there was no doubt that they didn't even bother paying lip service to it on the inside. Inside was a dictatorship presided over by Leo. And yet, it was Leo we had to thank for letting us see it in order to show it to the outside world. Leo, and thanks to her sterling work smuggling the camera in and then out again, and however she managed it, we certainly did not want to know, a prostitute called Margarita. Q is for quake. The fattest, healthiest dogs I've ever seen were in Haiti following the earthquake in 2010. The reason? Because there were so many bodies left lying around, they were never short of anything to eat. Arriving in the capital, Port-au-Prince, for an episode of Extreme World, we were greeted by scenes of utter devastation. The quake had struck on the 12th of January 2010, and a series of at least 52 aftershocks had continued until the 24th of January. The death toll was as high as 159,000, and an estimated 3 million people had been affected. What quickly became clear was an almost total lack of aftercare. A whole bunch of medical staff had arrived and sewed people up, and then left. Nobody locally knew to remove the sutures, which became infected and led to people dying. Corpses were still buried beneath rubble, food for rats and dogs. We saw a pair of legs sticking out from the bottom of a building when we first arrived, and a few weeks later they were still there. The only difference was that the trainers had gone, his jeans were no longer on his legs, and the dogs had picked away most of the flesh from his legs. In many cases, the only solution was to pour petrol into the demolished houses and set fire to what was in there. Everywhere you went, there were internally displaced persons' camps. Hundreds and hundreds of makeshift tents where abuse, rape, and violence were rife, and conditions were desperately insanitary. These were exactly the kind of conditions in which cholera thrives, and sure enough, a terrible situation had been considerably worsened by an outbreak. For the film, we joined a team of body collectors. This was like something out of the Dark Ages, real bring-out-your-dead stuff. The truck they were driving was piled high with bodies. When they come across an infected corpse, they plug up all the holes, upper and lower, with chlorine-soaked cotton wool in order to stop bacteria leaking out, because it's still infectious even after you're dead. They then spray the entire body and surrounding area with chlorine from a plastic tank on their back, much like a rose sprayer. To make matters worse, a lack of understanding meant that people were unaware how the disease spread, and they would often touch and sometimes kiss the corpses as they were being taken away. This meant that the body collectors would be back again in a few days' time. Tom Watson was standing in for sound that day, and we were halfway up a hillside collecting a body from a small village. As the corpse of an old lady was being sprayed by an overzealous body collector, Tom got a shot of chlorine right in the face and was temporarily blinded. For a while, I was his eyes, and managed to lead him down the hill. Left a bit, mate. Right a bit. Until we reached the vehicle. It took us nearly an hour, with him in considerable discomfort, and accompanied by a man carrying the dead old lady the whole way. Maybe we had a bit of a laugh about that later. And if that sounds harsh or inappropriate, you have to bear in mind that in a situation like Haiti, you either laugh or you cry. Sometimes both. R is for the thankfully rare glimpses of evil. People who do terrible things tend to believe their actions are justified, whether it's for political or tribal reasons, or perhaps because they believe they're righting a wrong or feel let down by society. They usually see themselves as being in the right, the oppressed, not the oppressors. They want to look in the mirror and see a good guy. Occasionally, though, you meet someone and you wonder just what on earth it is they see when they shave. Because beyond personal gain or gratification, there's nothing to justify their terrible wickedness. You wonder if they're just evil through and through. John Mungall was one of these without a doubt. See, J is for John Mungall. But there are a couple more worth mentioning. The first, his name was Satan, and I met him during my trip to the Congo. See, A is for Avez-vous la Boeuf. As I've already said, the war in the Democratic Republic of the Congo is funded through control of the mineral trade.